This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Kim Landers. On today's program, former cricket star turned politician Imran Khan claims victory in Pakistan's election and mapping Australia's shameful history of Aboriginal massacres.
We're looking at Aboriginal sources, we're looking at sources from police reports, newspaper reports and settler reports. You put all those together and you can get a very distressing story.
There's just one more full day of campaigning before the Super Saturday of five by-elections that could shake up Australian politics. It's the highest number of federal by-elections in a single day, and the government would break a 100-year drought if it picked up a seat from Labor tomorrow. So it's no surprise it's shaping up as a leadership test for both the Prime Minister and the opposition leader. It's so close in two of the seats, Longman in Queensland and Braddon in Tasmania, that the outcome is anyone's guess. The Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, joins me now in our Sydney studio. Prime Minister, good morning.
Good morning.
Are you increasingly confident of winning either Longman or Braddon, or perhaps both?
Well, as you've said, Kim, history is against us. It's the last time this happened was 100 years ago, and by-elections generally swing to in favour of the opposition, particularly if it's an opposition seat. But it is close, and the people in Longman and Braddon in particular, where it's especially close, have got the opportunity to say what they think about Bill Shorten's higher taxes, his anti-business agenda. You know, there are retirees, whether it's in Braddon or in Longman, perhaps on Bribey Island in Longman, who know that Bill Shorten is coming after their income. He wants to take away up to 30% of their income and his retiree tax. He wants higher taxes on businesses and individuals as well.
So do you rate the Liberal Party a good chance of picking up that seat then?
Well, Kim, it's close. You know, it's clearly close. But the only person that can deliver for Longman is Trevor Ruthenberg. The only person that can deliver for Braddon is Brett Whiteley.
You've said that these by-elections are a test of leadership between yourself and Bill Shorten. If you don't pick up a seat, what does that say about your leadership?
Well, I think it is a contest between the candidates. It's a contest between leaders. It's a contest between parties and policies. But I think the leadership, insofar as national leadership is become an issue, it seems to be mostly between Bill Shorten and Anthony Albanese at present. But I just
but
have to
you
say,
personally, Prime Minister, if you weren't able to pick up a seat, what do you think it means for you?
Well, it would mean that history has, you know, the 100-year tradition has been maintained.
Maker.
I mean, Kim, you know, it's not for me to be a commentator, but I think we both know that in reality, Labor should be way ahead in both seats. I mean, they should be way ahead in both seats. And the fact that it is close at all underlines the concerns that people have about the lies that Bill Shorten has been telling, the shocking lies he's been telling about health, which have become, that the lies themselves have become an issue in both seats, and of course the fact that he's waging this anti-business, high tax agenda. A vote for Bill Shorten's candidates in either seat is a vote for a weaker economy, fewer jobs, less investment and lower wages. I think Australians recognise, we take Queensland, for example. In Queensland, in the last month, more than a quarter of all the jobs created, over 50,000 jobs created across Australia, more than a quarter of them were created in Queensland. We're seeing strong jobs growth. Last calendar year, highest jobs growth in our history. Tasmania, on the other hand, in last month, had 2,100 new jobs created. That was, in percentage terms, the strongest jobs growth in the country. Of that is put at risk if people were to vote for Labor.
We've concentrated a lot on Longman and Braddon. There are some other contests. Mayo, for example, in South Australia is one of them. Have you given up hope of Georgina Downer winning Mayo?
Well, of course not. But it's a different contest. There's an independent there, Rebecca Sharkey. Most of the time she's voted with Bill Shorten.
Was it a mistake to pre-select Georgina Downer for that seat?
She's an outstanding candidate. She is an outstanding candidate.
Should she be given a chance to run again at a general election?
I'm sure she will run. Well, she said she will, and I'm sure she will run at the general election. And, that is at a general election, the choice is going to be much clearer.
But well, speaking of a general election, I mean, I know that you have said repeatedly that the election will be next year.
It will be next year.
You won't be a teeny bit tempted to bring that forward if you win a seat or two tomorrow
It'll be in the first half of next year.
Okay. On the media, the Nine Network's takeover of Fairfax, you've worked for the late Kerry Packer when he was bidding for control for the Fairfax Empire. What do you think he would be saying today about the state of Fairfax and the Nine Network, which he once
Well, I think, you know, Kerry was a very successful and pragmatic businessman, and he would recognise the media landscape has completely changed. And now, look, the truth is that Nine and Fairfax will be stronger together. It is our media world has never been more competitive or more diverse than it is at the moment. And I think that the future of both those businesses. I understand.
You don't think there might be a counter offer, perhaps, from someone like Seven West Media?
Well, there could be, but I mean, again, it's not. I'm not the business commentator, but I just say though that the ability of two businesses like that to be able to consolidate will put them in a stronger position to compete, and I think in a stronger position to support quality journalism,
there
whether it's in print or online or on TV.
There is some concern about that regional journalism, though. Fairfax has, you know, more than 100 regional papers, papers like the Burnie Advocate, the Launceston Examiner.
Yeah, sure.
Are you worried that it could spell the end of some of those smaller publications?
No, there's no reason why it would, Kim. In fact, I take quite an interest in the economics of the media industry, given my history in it. Actually, regional newspapers' ad revenues have held up better than the metropolitan papers. So, you know, regional media, print media generally is stronger. I mean, obviously the online Google and Facebook and everything else has knocked their revenues around, but they have done better in that environment than their metropolitan cousins have.
On MyHealth, the digital health record, you've said that the concerns raised by the various medical groups will be addressed. Will you specifically amend legislation to limit who can get access?
Well, the health minister's talking to the doctors about that, but you've just got to remember that the privacy rules were set up in 2012 under the Labor government.
I understand but I'm asking, would you make some specific changes to address those concerns to legislation?
Kim, it is being addressed by the health minister at the moment, and we are obviously going to do everything we can to reassure concerns, but I just want to stress to everyone that's listening to us this morning that My Health Record has been in place for 6 years. There are 6 million Australians with My Health Records. It has had bipartisan support. It's had strong support from the medical community.
So you're going to do whatever it takes to remove any doubt about that system. Is that what you're saying?
No, what I was saying, but you cut me off, was that it has been in place for 6 years. There are 6 million Australians with My Health Records. No records have been released, or privacy has been breached.
Other than medical groups are still raising some concern. So looking specifically, what could you do?
Well, again, that is a matter that's being addressed by the health minister. But I just want to provide this important message of reassurance that there are 6 million records, the 6 million My Health Records. The system's been operating for 6 years. There have been no privacy breaches, and the agency will not release. Would not, and they haven't been called to do so, but they would not release any record other than pursuant to a court order or a warrant. So in other words, a lot of the concerns that have been expressed, and I don't question them, I understand everyone is entitled to express these concerns, but there is nothing in the history or the practice of My
Health
Record.
And understanding all of that, looking forward, the minister has promised groups like the Royal Australian College of GPs that he will address their concerns, he will look at those privacy issues. So I'm just trying to tell our listeners a little bit of how the government might actually do that.
Well, that's for the minister to pursue with the colleges, the College of General Practitioners and the AMA. But I can give your listeners this assurance that the privacy of My Health Records has been maintained, it will be maintained, and that if there are changes that we can make to provide further reassurance, then obviously we're very open to doing so. But it's a matter for the minister to explore in his discussions with the doctors.
Prime Minister,
and
if,
others.
If I can take you to a matter overseas, Iran, do you believe that the US President Donald Trump is preparing for a military confrontation with Iran over its nuclear
well,
program?
Well, I have no reason to believe that. I saw a story today claiming that on the ABC and citing senior Australian government sources. The ABC, before putting that story out, did not contact me or my office. They did not contact the foreign minister or her office, the defence minister or her office, or the chief of the defence force. So I have to say I have no reason for believing that the story has any basis in fact.
So you have no knowledge of any of those sorts of US preparations?
The story has been... It's speculation, and of course it's citing anonymous sources. And
but you, as Prime Minister, what is your knowledge of the US attitude towards Iran?
Well, I mean, President Trump has made his views very clear to the whole world. But the story on the ABC, which cites senior Australian government sources, has not benefited from any consultation with me, the foreign minister, the defence minister, or the chief of the defence force. So perhaps you should inquire of the authors of the article.
All right. Prime Minister, thank you very much for joining
AM
this morning. We appreciate it. And as the Prime Minister will be heading to Queensland later today ahead of those Super Saturday of by-elections, our reporter George Roberts has been in the Queensland seat of Longman. He's been testing voters' views.
Moray Field Shopping Centre's the kind of place you'd expect to find in an electorate where wages tend to be below the national average. Budget and discount stores and cops on the beat. In the hair salon, 18-year-old Caitlin is in her fourth year of apprenticeship. She's voting age but not registered.
There's quite a few people that are unemployed, yeah.
So unemployment is a big issue.
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
28-year-old Larissa is a client of the salon.
I'm getting blonde foils done.
Is it a special occasion?
No, just because.
She's already decided to vote Labor.
I think people are doing it really, really tough. Some of the main issues are around jobs and the cost of living.
Labor's Susan Lamb will need every vote she can get. She snatched the seat from Wyatt Roy in 2016 with a margin of less than 1%, or fewer than 1,400 votes after preferences. It's a slim gap, and the Coalition's candidate, Trevor Ruthenberg, is set to benefit from strong One Nation preferences. It's polling about 15% of the vote, compared to about 9% last time. John Mickle was once the Speaker of the Queensland Parliament. He's now an Adjunct Associate Professor at Queensland's University of Technology, or QUT.
So this is a seat where One Nation do well, not because of who they are, but because of who they are not. It depends on how much they have carved out the Liberal and National Party vote.
He sees the battle as being how Malcolm Turnbull and Bill Shorten can spin the result, whether they win or lose.
I don't think this contest is so much as for who wins on Saturday night. It'll be who's going to win next week. The federal government has been clever in shaping this as a contest about Bill Shorten. Bill Shorten, on the other hand, has been content to shape it as a question for the Prime Minister. So I think the battle really will be next week.
Dr. Paul Williams is a political commentator from Griffith University.
Because we're at this point of the electoral cycle, the opinion polls keep bouncing around with Labor only very slightly ahead of the Coalition. It just makes the contest that's more interesting. So I think it's really taken on through the news media. It really has taken on the aspects of a gladiatorial contest between two giants, simply because the contest for the next election is so close, and so close in terms of numbers, but also so close in terms of time. I mean, we could be facing a federal election within a matter of months.
How do you think it'll play out on the day then?
Look, I think this really will go down to the wire. I mean, there could be as little as 100 votes in it, but I don't think we'll get a result on the night. The really interesting thing is all eyes should be on not just how many votes One Nation should get, and they probably should poll about 15%, but where One Nation preferences go. The LNP is banking on One Nation preferences, leeching to the Coalition in very large numbers. But I certainly wouldn't bank on it. I think the Labor Party is looking forward to attracting up to 40% of One Nation preferences, and that's probably Susan Lamb's only saving grace.
Dr. Paul Williams from Griffith University, ending that report from George Roberts. Wayne Swan is the incoming Labor National President and former Treasurer and Deputy Prime Minister. His Queensland electorate of Lilly isn't too far from Longman, and I spoke to him a short time ago. Wayne Swan, good morning.
Good morning.
How apprehensive are you about Labor's chances of hanging on to Longman and Braddon?
Well, these are tough contests, and they're not the only contests that we're having this weekend. I mean, there are other by-elections on as well, where the Liberals have got a bit of strife, but they are two tough seats for Labor, no doubt about that. Longman has only been held once for Labor in the last 22 years prior to Susan winning the seat. And, of course, Braddon has moved backwards and forwards like a yo-yo over a 20-year period. So tough seats for Labor.
Given an incumbent government has not won a seat off the opposition in a by-election in a century, wouldn't losing a seat or two to a second-term government be really embarrassing for Labor?
Well, I think we ought to just put a couple of facts on the table, particularly in regard to Longman. I mean, Longman, last time, we had a One Nation ticket directed towards us, the only place in the country. If that ticket had not been directed towards us, Susan Lamb would have got 48% of the vote. So she's effectively got to get a 2% swing because of the gang up between One Nation and the Liberal Party. So Longman is very tough from that point of view. It's effectively a three-way contest where you've got One Nation and the Liberal Party in bed together. And, of course, Tassie, always volatile.
What are the implications for Bill Shorten's leadership if there is a by-election loss for Labor?
Absolutely none. What we've had over a period of 5 years has been an unprecedented degree of unity. We've got a very courageous policy program. We came within a whisker of winning the last federal election.
So you say
the party absolutely understands the importance of unity.
So you say the importance of unity. So you're absolutely sure there'd be no move against him. Is it because it's too messy, or that the Labor Party rules protect a leader against a caucus that starts to panic?
Actually, it is none of those things. It is for Labor, it is for the country, the sensible thing to do. Now, our team on the front bench over a long period of time have put together a very important and very big program for the future of this country. The electorate in this country want us focusing on the needs of the people, not looking inwards at ourselves.
Anthony Albanese has given his guarantee he won't challenge Mr. Shorten. Do you believe him?
Yes, I do, because everybody in the front bench particularly, but in the caucus and more broadly in the community, wants to see parties united and getting on with the job of putting forward a program for the future so that the people can make their choice. They can make their choice between Bill Shorten and Labor, which have got a program for growth and a program to make the country fairer over time, and the Liberal Party, who just want to hand over public policy to the top end of town. We've got a great example of that now when we're looking at what's happening with media. Big corporations run this country via the Liberal Party, and people are fed up with it.
On another issue, should your backbench colleague, Emma Hussar, who's under investigation for bullying her staff, making them do babysitting, picking up the dog poo, should she quit Parliament?
Absolutely no. She is entitled to justice, to natural justice.
When did you find out about the allegations?
I was unaware of the allegations, like most people in the country and most people in the Labor Party. But look, put that to one side. It's not about that. It's actually about testing the allegations, giving Emma some natural justice. I know that's that should be something that everyone is entitled to, but apparently not Emma. Well, she is entitled to it, and she's going to get it from the Labor Party.
Is it a bad look that Bill Shorten was kept in the dark about the investigation last week?
This is one of those sort of beat-ups that really bring politics into disrepute. The truth is there's a process going on. It's been done in good faith, and Emma is entitled to natural justice.
Wayne Swan, thank you very much for talking to 2AM this morning.
Thank you.
Incoming Labor National President Wayne Swan. This is 2AM Around Australia, and it's 19 minutes past 8. Former international cricket star Imran Khan is poised to become Pakistan's next prime minister after an election dogged by claims of vote rigging. Even though his PTI party is unlikely to win a majority, Imran Khan is claiming victory. Our South Asia correspondent is Siobhan Hinyu. Siobhan, Imran Khan has given a victory speech. What did he have to say?
Well, Kim, he started off on quite a pessimistic note. He said that Pakistan is in shambles and that the economy has never been so abysmal. Rather accurate observations. He said that no country can be successful when it has an island of rich people living in a sea of poverty. And he doubled down on that really core campaign centrepiece promise of his to end corruption in the country, which is, of course, what the former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif was just convicted of a couple of weeks before the election. And he took it all a step further by saying that he would refuse to live in the Prime Minister's official residence, saying that it was too grand for him. A couple of other interesting things that came out of that victory speech. One was a bit of a statement on his intentions regarding foreign relations. And we haven't heard a lot about what he intends to do on that front. Here's a little bit of what he had to say about the kind of relationship he wanted to build with the United States.
I want mutually beneficial relations with the United States, relations that can be beneficial for both countries. Until now, our relations with the US have been one way. The US thinks that they fund Pakistan for fighting their war, but Pakistan has suffered great loss. Now we want a balanced relationship between the two countries.
So, Siobhan, how difficult is it going to be for Imran Khan to actually form a coalition?
Well, not as difficult as originally expected, and that's because he's polled better than expected. In fact, he's won three times the seats that he did in the last elections in 2013 when his party came third. So he's got over 100 seats, which is more than double of what the nearest rival, Nawaz Sharif's PML party has. So what he'll probably be dealing with is a motley assortment of independents rather than any large coalition partners, and that might give him a little more influence. But of course, the unspoken partner in any coalition will be the Pakistani military, and it will be interesting to see how Imran Khan responds to the military seeking to influence, particularly foreign policy.
South Asia correspondent Siobhan Hinyu. The former head of Britain's intelligence and security organisation has warned against ignoring Huawei or trying to ban the Chinese telecommunications giant. Robert Hannigan, who was the director of GCHQ, says the West needs to find a way to work with Huawei because of the superiority of its technology. But as the Australian government decides if Huawei will be part of the 5G bidding process, the UK has been given a stark warning on security. From London, Europe correspondent Lisa Miller reports.
A television ad for one of Huawei's earlier phone models in the UK shows a young boy coming home upset because he hasn't been picked for the football team. His dad gives him a new phone with a message, "Prove them wrong." Of course, he goes on to score a goal and makes the team. It's a message Huawei themselves must be following as it tries to find a way into the Australian market. But if its experience in the UK is anything to go by, it's a roller coaster ride.
So in the future, there will be lots of technologies which we need where the best provider in the world and the best technology is Chinese. What are we going to do about that? Are we going to cut ourselves off from it, or are we going to find a way of managing the risk?
Robert Hannigan is the former director of Britain's intelligence and security organisation, GCHQ. Nigel Inkster is a 30-year veteran of the Secret Intelligence Service.
What we need to do is look at this in the broader strategic context of who controls and dominates these technologies at a global level in the 21st century.
Both men have high-level, intricate knowledge of Huawei and its more than 15 years of operating in the UK.
I think you know those in the intelligence and security community were from the outset aware of the problems that this relationship could cause, but one has to bear in mind that we were this was taking place in a different era. We were still in a kind of end of history moment.
The UK established what's been known as the CEL, a group of cybersecurity experts working in a nondescript brown brick building in an industrial estate 90 minutes north of London. They look for any vulnerabilities in Huawei's software and hardware. The staff are employed by the Chinese company and overseen by the British government. That's been put forward as a model for Australia. But the latest report from the Oversight Board for the Cell says that shortcomings in Huawei's engineering processes have exposed new risks for the networks, and they could give only limited assurance about security. Robert Hannigan.
And it looks like a bit of a warning shot is being fired by the UK government over this.
Both men are sceptical of Huawei's claim to independence.
And if the Chinese government asks them to do something, they're not in a position to refuse.
You have to be realistic about the fact that any major company based in China operates under Chinese law, under scrutiny from the Chinese state and its agencies. That's life.
Britain's ties are now deep with Huawei, and they believe they've put in the processes that will help them keep the security tight around their critical network infrastructure. But these two senior security advisers, who've been at the peak of their industries in Britain, say it will always be a balance between risk and reward when signing up to do business with Huawei. This is Lisa Miller in London for AM.
Historians have now mapped 250 massacres of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes across the nation during the time of frontier conflict. And as hundreds of people come forward with new information on sites that have been long forgotten, there's increasing discussion about how Australia should remember these massacres. Here's Indigenous Affairs correspondent Bridget Brennan.
On a warm winter's day at Appin, southwest of Sydney, Uncle Ivan Wellington perches on a rock overlooking a modest monument to one of Australia's most well-known massacres.
It's a dark chapter in the history of what became and what happened to the Dharawal people on their lands. That's why we come here and show respect to these people.
In April 1816, 14 Aboriginal men, women and children were killed by soldiers during a military operation. Some fled over the cliff as the soldiers approached on horseback. A plaque at the site is a tribute to the dead. It reads, "We are deeply sorry. We will remember them."
I found peace here, you know, contented of remembering these people, you know, learning of them. And it must have been terrible, like, what took place.
A team at the University of Newcastle has been marking these sites on a digital map. They've just hit a sobering milestone. There are now 250 massacres recorded in every state and territory except Western Australia.
We find out more details than we expected to find because the sources are richer. We're looking at Aboriginal sources, we're looking at sources from police reports, newspaper reports and settler reports. You put all those together and you can get a very distressing story. There's no doubt it's very confronting work.
Professor Lyndall Ryan is one of Australia's foremost experts on frontier conflict. Since the map went live, hundreds of Australians have contacted her wanting to add new information.
We've been spending the last year double-checking every new piece of information that we've got. People from regional Australia have been the people most likely to contact us.
Professor Ryan suspects there'll be about 500 sites on the map when it's finished, and there are now several new editions of the massacres of settlers by Aboriginal tribes.
It's an unending war in a way, and wherever settlement spreads, we're going to get massacres. So it's sort of a very dominant part of Australian history that we have to come to terms with.
Monuments and markers to what is often called the frontier wars are cropping up around Australia. Wiradjuri artist Brooke Andrew has spent 2 years visiting massacre sites overseas.
And I think one of the most important things about speaking with and spending time with people from overseas around sites of trauma is really about forgiveness and the kind of ways in which that people can reconcile with their own trauma and their own pasts, and then therefore how they can kind of educate the kind of broader community. And so some communities, like for example the Document Centre in Cambodia around the killing fields, have created education kits.
Brooke Andrew believes that type of recognition is missing here in Australia.
Still today, that recognition is not that visible. And so when it comes to a national memorialisation, I think that that kind of space to commemorate is definitely missing. And I think there needs to be some kind of structure or building or even consciousness around what that is.
That's Wiradjuri artist Brooke Andrew with Bridget Brennan. To finance news now, the embattled wealth manager AMP says its first half profit will drop as the business is reset in the wake of scandals revealed in the Financial Services Royal Commission. AMP is putting aside $290 million to remediate customers caught up in bad advice. There'll also be fee reductions for around 700,000 customers. And that is AM for today. AM's executive producer is Michael Edwards. The associate producer is Barney Porter. Technical production by Alan Arthur and Kem White. Digital production by Maisie Cohen. And web publishing by Sarah Tonkin and Matthew Bates. I'm Kim Landers. I'll be back on Monday. Have a great weekend.